Last time was 2 weeks ago, really, and we were speaking about court Jews. But in the meantime, I have gotten some new sources of information. And I'm going to revise a little bit of some of the things I said. I was basing it on a reliable source, but I found a better source. What? Say again? No, Mamish not. It's actually very fascinating. It's a very fascinating discovery. Okay, so when we were speaking about Ashkenazi Jewry, I commented that most major legal entities, countries, they weren't really countries, they were like dukedoms and kingdoms, etc., earldoms, whatever you're going to call them, in Ashkenaz expelled the Jews from the late 1400s to the late 1500s. That was like a general rule. By the late 1500s, there was almost every single major country in Germany had expelled Jews. The major exception, what was the ecclesiastic states, that's what we spoke about. There was another minor exception to Jonathan Israel, who wrote the famous, groundbreaking book on this age, which is called The Jews in the Age of Mercantilism. That is the groundbreaker in this. It's like fascinating. But I'll diverge a little more to talk about Professor Israel in a moment. We're talking about Germany. So he missed one thing. And that it's sort of like expected. And what he missed was there was a, and I didn't have time to verify the numbers on this one, which I could do on a different book that I own. But there were people who were called imperial knights and imperial counts. The Holy Roman Empire had over 1,000 to 1,500 components. States. There were larger territories, electorates and dukedoms, etc. Then there were smaller territories. They got even smaller and smaller. You had people who were called imperial knights and imperial counts. They were, as it says somewhere, whatever. Diamond. The imperial knights and imperial counts, they, as it says in other places, not in Jewish sources, it says, Ki'ilu, they didn't appear to be that much different than prosperous peasants. In terms of the amount of territory they ruled, it could just be a couple of farms. It could be a couple of farms or a very small little village, or a couple, three or four small villages. And you had prosperous peasants who had the same amount of holdings. There's one major nafkamina, one major difference between an imperial knight, an imperial count, and a prosperous peasant. An imperial knight or an imperial count, even though he didn't have that much holdings, he legally was independent. And if he wanted to contest his independence, he had the right to appeal to the emperor. Now, the people who wanted to contest his independence would be larger states, and the emperor, who wanted to maintain as much of his own power as possible, one of the ways he maintained it was not allowing any of the smaller people under him, who were still relatively large, he did not want them to absorb these imperial counts and knights into their territory, because that would have made them more powerful. So the emperor almost inevitably would back the imperial knights and imperial counts. That's just basic German constitution. Now, what happened was it's sort of like a mystery. In other words, we know as a fact that Jews were expelled from the vast majority of German cities and towns, etc., etc., etc. Yet German Jewry, Yekish Jewry, does not have a collective memory of having moved to Poland and moved back. But we don't really find that. We don't find amongst Yeks, amongst proper people who are of German Jewish descent, they will always tell you, we've been in Ashkenaz, we've been in Germany for 1,000 years, or we were in Germany for 1,000 years. They will consistently tell you that. And it's certainly not 100% true, because there's no question that a certain amount of them did move to Poland and move back. But still, nonetheless, if that would have been true about basically all of them, then there should be some echo to that historical truism. So my answer to it is, is based on my newest piece of information. My answer to it is that there were, this is, I saw in a book that's just been printed in the last year or two. It's a new book on German Jewish history, starting from the 1500s and it goes all the way up to the modern era. It's actually printed by HUC, Hebrew Union College. Reform, that's the Reform Seminary. Okay, whatever. I mean, they make their mistakes, but whatever. Anyway, so but they do point out, and then he didn't even point it out he wasn't trying to point it out, but he does point out over there that you did have a small amount of Jews who were able to escape. In other words, they were expelled from the large territories. They didn't all move into the ecclesiastic states. They didn't all move east. Some of them simply found your local imperial knight who was willing to take two or three Jews into his territory for money. And they were able to maintain a certain semblance of continuity in Germany. That's like an important... That answers... I was like puzzled. What? I'm not sure, but enough that when the German Jewish communities were refounded in the 1600s, that it wasn't that all the Jews were coming from Poland. Because if they were, there should be some type of historical memory to that. And there's not. There's not, mamish not. So where were they coming from? They were all just coming from the ecclesiastic states? That didn't sound mustavra. Did not feel that was true. So where they were coming from is they came from a lot of them had gone into the smallest entities of the Holy Roman Empire of Germany and survived there.
And the knights were allowed to survive.
The knights had legal independence. The knights and counts were holding such small territories that generally speaking you don't even have communities there, because you're talking about villages of, you know, like they would rule a couple of villages. Each village had like, you know, 80 to 100 people in it. So how many Jews would they allow, and how many Jews could it support? It absolutely existed. The Holy Roman Empire started in the year 800 with Charlemagne, 780 whatever. It went all the way to 1806, dude.
Really?
Yep.
So then how do we understand that in the context of like French rule during that time?
France was taking bites out of the Holy Roman Empire starting with Louis XIV, which is like about where we're holding.
So, at the time that it was fully concluded, the Holy Roman Empire, what did it control? What did it control at the time? It's like
in this period of time.
Right now.
In this period of time, Germany was part of the Holy Roman Empire. Germany, Northern Italy may still have been. I'm not sure. What? No, the farthest east it went was what they used to call Bohemia Moravia, which is today the Czech Republic.
Yes, that's east.
That's
east of Macedonia.
Macedonia? Macedonia is southern Europe, man. It's Greece. It's on top of Greece.
Northern Italy. My bad. I don't know why.
Right. Switzerland originally was, but already by this time probably was not legally part of the Holy Roman Empire. Belgium probably was still legally part of the Holy Roman Empire. That's about it.
And France and Spain.
France was definitely not. Western France, Eastern France, at earlier parts of Eastern France were still legally part of the Holy Roman Empire.
What about Spain?
Spain, no. The ruler of Spain was the first cousin and the brother-in-law and the uncle, probably, I'm just guessing, of the Spanish Habsburgs and the Austrian Habsburgs. But they were only united, the only person who united the Habsburg Empire as a whole, of course, was Charles V, but that he resigned in 1553 or something like that, you know, plus or minus a couple
Charlemagne
years.
Charlemagne ruled the Holy Roman Empire.
Charlemagne. Say again? Yes, he did. He did not rule. That's where it started from. He ruled France, about half of Germany, and Italy down to Rome.
So it moved east.
It definitely did. It definitely did.
And
of course, it was Gaul.
And Yeah, true. And did it become more...
Okay, now France broke off shortly after that. It was considered legally independent. And the whole... You were there. Everyone was Catholic. Every Christian in Europe was Catholic until 1521. What?
Lay investiture.
I don't know. What about it? Okay, tough. Let's go on. Okay. Chop. Okay. Now, okay. I also want another book I picked up. I was like reading it here over Shabbos in my spare time. Ke'ilu was the Bible. One of the Bible books, Ke'ilu, of the court Jews. There was a book written by someone by the name of Selma Stern.
Selma.
She wrote the book, she started writing the book in the 20s and finished the book off in the mid late 30s under a lot of very difficult situation because she was Jewish, trying to write Jewish history in Nazi Germany. The Nazis were busy trying to get rid of all the archives that showed Jews in a positive way. She managed to do it anyway. She wrote her book on the court Jew is considered one of the definitive books, and basically everyone after her is definitely using her book as one of their primary sources of information.
On the
phenomenon of the court Jew. She did the research, on the ground research on the court Jew, and I'm not sure how many people have gone back and redone it since then. That's just how things work. But you have to understand that a historian has his pieces of expertise, and how much of the all real research he does is a good question. And you have to read it very carefully to figure it out yourself. They're usually relying on other people's research to an extent, some larger, some greater. How much scrutiny they give other experts' opinions depends on the person. Okay. Anyway, that was just a line for the ages here. Just let me go off record for a moment here. Okay. Fine. So Selma Stern, she wrote the Bible on the court Jew, and her take on it is sort of like this. She divides up the court Jews. Influence into four main spheres, and that is military supplies, court needs, jewels. Now you think court needs and jewels are not the exact same thing, but whatever, they're similar but not the exact same thing. And finally, minting coins, and the minting coins we'll get to, I hope, next week. That was a major source of problem in Germany. Was coin minting, and there are at least two well-known episodes to myself where countries severely debased the coin. Now, we understand what that means? That in the old days...
Like a circus?
Debased. You know what debasing is?
Yeah, but maybe they were called...
Okay, it's sort of like this.
It's
like this, here. See, why is... Here, let's take out our money here. Why is this worth 2 shekels? Because the government says it's worth 2 shekels. Why is this worth 10 shekels? Because the government said it was worth 10 shekels. It doesn't have any intrinsic value.
Fiduciary.
Back in the old days, how did coins work? Well, in theory, the coin had a certain amount of silver in it. It definitely originally did. And the country known for never debasing their coins... No. Spain didn't really have to.
They lived and died by their gold.
Yeah, by the silver even. Spain didn't have to, because Spain conquered the two greatest sources of silver in the world. Mexico and South America. I mean, Potosi was the White Mountain in Peru. It was the rocks had so much silver in them, they were like white rocks.
And destroyed them.
Well, they did. They didn't. No one understood it. They kept importing more silver and couldn't understand why it was worth less.
Do you think that inflation became was understood as an economic phenomenon after that happened?
The first person who understood it was Adam Smith.
Well, that was how many years ago?
That was much later. That was in the
late. 100 years later.
That's right. You're 100 years. Adam Smith, the early 1700s.
Let's see. 15.
They didn't understand it. 1560s, 1570s, 1590s, in the 1700s maybe they were picking it up already. But in the key age, in the golden age of Spain, 1492 until 1630 or so, 1630 or so. Yeah, plus minus. That period of time, 1621 I think is when they ended. In that period of time, the Spanish didn't understand it. We just keep bringing more silver in. And where is it going to? They didn't realize. They didn't understand it. Anyway, but that's not it. That's not it. But debasing is different than that. The country that never debased their coins were the English. They never debased. The English coin did not. The English never debased it. And they invented the serrated edge. Do you know why they invented the serrated edge?
These aren't serrated.
Yeah, no, they're not. Because our coins don't have real silver in them, man. Because English coin was sterling, was a pound sterling, was because it was made out of sterling silver originally. And in order that you shouldn't take a knife and carve some silver off for yourself, which you could do, knife made out of iron, coin made out of silver base, iron stronger than silver, so what do? You just take your coin and you take the coin and you rub the edges and you can get some silver for yourself. So the English invented the serrated edge. When I see a serrated edge, I know the coin is completely intact.
Because
you can see. You can see. That's why this is like a mock English coin. Like, that's why the coins in America, which used to be silver...
Although today they hold no intrinsic value.
There's no silver at all in them. But the dime, the quarter, the half dollar, which were originally silver, all have serrated edge. The nickel, which it doesn't...
Does not.
You got it?
That's how I love doing the nickel. Like rubbing it.
That's right. A nickel, it's not only its size, it's also smooth on the edge. Anyway, Bekitzer, the Austrians and the Prussians, both at different significant points in their history when they were fighting wars and they needed money, one of the ways they made more money was they took in all the old coins, which were, let's say, 60-70% silver, and they sent out new coins, which were 5 or 10% silver. But they said they were worth the same thing. They said this is one talar.
So
they said this is one gilding.
So
or whatever it was.
System and banknotes and all that stuff.
That's much later. That's much later. It's much later. Much later. The 1800s,
1900s. Were they the first people to do that?
To debase?
No,
the Romans
did. To take back money and then send back.
I'm not sure. That's an interesting question. In other words, the Romans debased coins also, but they did not have as good of a centralized government as even the Austrians had. And what would they do?
The Prussians had a great
system. And they would take all the old coins back and give you new coins and say, okay, you have to come give your coins in.
What's the purpose of debasing?
Because silver cost a lot, and brass and other things they were making out of didn't cost as much. And the government made immense profits in order to keep the war going. They had to pay their soldiers. And they were paying them in Prussian currency, the Prussian talar.
So the money was just...
That's right. And who do you think were the main agents of the king doing this?
The Jews.
That's right.
Only Jews didn't think of that.
Oh. No, the Jews didn't think of it. That's what's her name's point. That is Stern's point. Is the Jews in this were not initiators of the policy. They carried out the policy. Why did they carry out the policy and no one else was willing to do it? There's two points like this. Is they could do it better. That's A. But the other point is like this also. Whoever was educated until 1700 usually was either a nobleman or a church person. And those people had their own interests. And the absolute monarchs at this period of time, they wanted someone who was going to do the monarch's, the ruler's will and nothing else. And if they took someone who had their own interests, it wouldn't work. So they took the Jews, because the Jews would do exactly what they wanted. And if there was a problem, they could just get rid of them. And they sometimes did. They weren't always like one of the early debasers, it wasn't as significant as Frederick the Great, but in an earlier period in Prussian history where they debased coins, the king literally gave the Jewish person who did it for him over to the mob, and they literally killed him. I mean, they tried him, they had an official trial, but he was literally whipped to death. Okay, weiter. Let's do Samuel Oppenheimer. Let's hit Samuel Oppenheimer. Samuel Oppenheimer, 1630 to 1703. He started out in the Palatinate. Now the Palatinate was a German electorate. That had territories in two or three parts of the Holy Roman Empire. It's most famous, of course, because the elector of the Palatinate was the candidate who attempted to rebel and take the Bohemian crown from the Austrians in the beginning of the Thirty Years' War.
Bohemia
is southeast. Bohemia is north, is directly north of Austria. Czech. The Czech Republic is Bohemia. Okay? That is what the Palatinate is most known for. That's what they're most known for. Okay. That's where he started out. It was a middle-sized electorate in the Holy Roman Empire. Famously, see, it's not a Styria. In other words, all the different German states were, as we say, sort of related to each other, sort of not. He went on from there to becoming the key court Jew for the Austrian Habsburgs. The Austrian Habsburgs, you know, as they say, you know, there was Prussian efficiency and there was Austrian Schlumperei. You know, like disorganization. The way the Austrians got through all this was they had a lot of court Jews. That's how they managed to invest in this period of time. Later on, they did develop some more. The Austrians never got that efficient. But at this early period, the way they ruled a lot. The Austrians ruled about 30% of the Holy Roman Empire, approximately, plus minus, which was a significant amount of it.
At the time of its dissolvement?
Well, even at the time of its dissolvement. Maybe even 30-35%. So they employed a number of court Jews, and the most important one was Samuel Oppenheimer. His most famous accomplishment was supplying the army, supplying Eugene of Savoy. Have you heard of Eugene? No. Eugene of Savoy was a Italian-born person. He was Italian, and he offered his services to the emperor, to the head of the Austrian Habsburgs, and he helped them reconquer Hungary. Now, Hungary had been conquered by the Turks in what year, Diamond?
1453.
Hungary. No, 1526, Mohawks. Okay.
They conquered
before
Hungary.
That's right.
How's that work?
Constantinople, they're almost...
It just seems geographically it makes sense that they'd go through...
No, the Turks are starting in Turkey.
The Turks. The Turks, obviously,
they
go the other way. Yeah.
Suleiman the Magnificent conquered, defeated Louis of Austria in 1526 in the famous Battle of Mohawks.
Like using the Mohawk?
No, the name's a city called Mohawks. No, that's American Indian.
So why they call Mohawk?
I don't know. No, I'm not sure if there's any relation to one to another. Okay, he defeated from 1526 until the late 1600s. Hungary was under Ottoman. Most of Hungary, 90% of Hungary, was ruled by the Turks or a Turkish vassal. The Austrians reconquered Hungary in the late 1600s. The person who reconquered Hungary for the Austrians was a man by the name of Eugene of Savoy. Eugene of Savoy was not Austrian at all. He was Italian. He was half Italian, half French. He tried to join up with Louis XIV. Louis XIV looked at him and he called him, "Ah, you look like you should be a monk. You don't look like you should be a general. You don't have enough of a, you know, well, you don't have a machismo character or personality." And there are people who hold this was the biggest mistake that Louis XIV ever made, because he went and then offered his services to Louis XIV's opponent, who was the Holy Roman Emperor, and he said, "Bavakasha, I'm happy to have you." And he went first and helped the Austrians reconquer Hungary with Jewish suppliers helping him, mainly Samuel Oppenheimer. And later, Eugene Savoy defeated the French armies together with Churchill, Churchill's great-great-grandfather, Duke of Marlborough, in the War of Spanish Succession.
What type of fighting do they use in
the
1600s
war? This is the era of muskets and bayonets.
That's the very beginning of it.
Wait, so what year did they retake Hungary?
From 1686 to 1693, approximately, plus minus.
How long did the Turks have?
150 in Eastern Europe.
Ooh.
Which part? Hungary or lower down?
Well, lower down they probably had.
Them. Lower down, they ruled lower down until almost 1800s.
They pushed Hungary.
They ruled from 1526 to they ruled for 150 years. That was overextending. They ruled parts of southern Ukraine. Okay. Fine. Right here. Let's get a couple of other important stuff in. Let's get another couple of important things in. We're probably going to call it after this because the next person, I'm not pushing in because he's too famous. And I really want to do more reading on more famous. I'll tell you his name. We'll see how much you know about him. We'll see how much you know. Yud Sus. The Yud Sus.
Someone he's known as someone else.
What?
Yud
Sus.
We know about him. We don't know his name. He's called.
His real name was Joseph Sus Oppenheimer. But we're not going to do him today. Dangle. That's for next week. He's the most famous, infamous court Jew who ever lived. And that's for next week. But first, let's finish off Samuel Oppenheimer, who was the Yud Sus' uncle. Okay, now. It's sort of like this. The Samuel Oppenheimer is going to bring us to a very, very interesting and fascinating incident, which is only indirectly related to the court Jew, but it is fascinating, and I can't resist saying it over, because you'll see. The Austrian Habsburgs, even though they employed lots of court Jews, as you may be aware, were very devout Catholics, and the Jesuits, as is very well known, had wielded an immense amount of power. In the Austrian Empire. As a matter of fact, the reconstituted Austrian Empire, which starts with Ferdinand II, 1615 or so, he was a very, very devout Catholic and Talmud and student of the Jesuits. And that he is the reason why, he is like the real cause of the 30 Years' War. Whatever. I don't want to get into all those details. That's not that pertinent to us. But so it's like sort of, it was sort of an irony that but it's very typical. In other words, Charles V did a similar thing even though they were very devout Catholics, they would favor Jews not because they really liked us, but rather because my enemy's enemy is my friend / people who I could use and get something positive out of, I will. So they used the Habsburgs and the Austrian Habsburgs specifically had been using the Jews as a counterweight to the Protestants for a very long time. But that did not stop Leopold, I believe is his name, but I didn't bother writing it down, from expelling the Jews from Vienna in 1670. That's a very, very famous, that's the last major expulsion of Jews from anywhere. There are some minor ones afterwards, but that is the last major time the Jews were expelled pre-Nazi era. Pre-Nazis...
The Jews were expelled from
Austria? No, just from Vienna. Originally, he wanted to expel from the entirety of...
Elsewhere in Austria or out of Austria altogether?
Say again?
From Vienna to elsewhere in Austria?
Okay, so initially he wanted to expel them completely from Austria. There was a lot of pressure put on him One of the most famous people who was involved was Christina, the former queen of Sweden. Okay. So she's a very fascinating character. Amongst other things, she employed one of her finances were taken care of by a former Murano whose name was Diego Teixeira. So she was very involved. Other people were involved. And of course, the great elector who was trying to turn Prussia into a major state. He didn't like officially oppose it, but he invited any Jews who were expelled from Austria. Not any. He invited the well-to-do ones to move to Berlin. And that is the beginning of the Jewish community in Berlin. Now, the point... That's right. Okay. Now, it's like this. The Swedish consul in Vienna commented on the dignity of the Jews who were being expelled from Vienna. Not one agreed to stay and baptize themselves. Not one. And that is a very fascinating, fascinating incident.
Compared to Spain.
Compared to Spain, not even 200 years before that, where about a third of the Jews stayed. And B is if this would have happened 100 years later, I'm scared to think of what would have happened. Ki'ilu.
Their lives were much better, probably, in Spain at that time than they were in...
I don't know if that's true. No, I don't know if that's true. It was an old Ashkenazi custom up until the modern times. As a matter of fact, I very much don't believe in being small-minded and saying, we're better than you. But Lamai said that you have to know that Ashkenazi Jewry, up until modern times, was known for refusing baptism. And the Rishonim were very puzzled why Ashkenazi Jews, as a rule, refused. And Spanish Jews had the problem. That was.
It's funny today because...
So as I said, because today the shoe's on the other foot.
Yeah.
That's true.
That's
definitely true. But historically it wasn't always like that. I don't know. This is a very fascinating thing. Jews were not legally readmitted to Vienna until 1863 or so. Maybe it's 1866. There were Jews living in Vienna. The Jewish community restarted in Vienna not illegally, unofficially, with Samuel Oppenheimer. Samuel Oppenheimer, who not much after this, in the 1680s or so, was given rights of residence, personal rights of residence for him and his household, and he had a massive household. He did not have a minor household. He had a massive household of over 100 registered people, which means you should assume there were also people who were not registered. And he wasn't the only registered court Jew. There was X amount of court Jews registered, so that, you know, there was an unofficial Jewish community in Vienna, which started from Samuel Oppenheimer. Fine. Adcon, guys.